What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Jeff Booth is a visionary leader who has lived at the forefront of technology culture for 20 years. He led BuildDirect, a technology company that aimed to simplify the building industry. For nearly two decades, through the dot-com meltdown, the 2008 financial crisis, and many waves of technological disruption. Jeff has been featured in Forbes, TechCrunch, Inc., Fast Company, Entrepreneur, Bloomberg, Time, and the Wall Street Journal. In 2015, he was named BC Technology Industry Association's Technology Person of the Year. And in 2016, Goldman Sachs named him among its 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. Jeff is a founding partner at Audio Labs, co-founder of Knock Knock and AddyInvest.com, and serves on many boards. He's also been a Young Presidents Organization member since 2004 and contributes time as a founding fellow on Creative Destruction Lab. He is author of The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future, the best book I've read in years. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Jeff. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Cedric.
Oh, this is so awesome. You know, I enjoyed the book tremendously. It's really a hallmark for me this year. Kind of made me look at things a lot differently. And I'm curious, what have you made of the reaction to the book since it came out in January?
I've been blown away. So it's turned into a bestseller in multiple countries. It's being translated into a whole bunch of different languages for distribution in other markets. But that was completely unexpected I thought it would be, when I wrote it, I was actually really worried about the fallout from it. Mm. Anytime you go up against an existing system that has so much inertia and everything else, and you're going up and against the entire system that we take for granted that we live in, quite honestly, I was really concerned about what that would look like, what that would look like for my family, everything else, because normally, even if you're right on something like that, the world doesn't want to look at something. It's been an amazing ride, but largely unexpected.
Kind of touching on the concern, you know, I kind of think of you as the CEO's CEO. You're on numerous boards. I'm sure you get asked to be on hundreds of boards every year. And so you're really connected. And I wonder how much of your concern was kind of sharing your thoughts of, you know, you're thinking behind the scenes, because you are influencing a lot of enterprises and companies and individuals who drive those companies. Was that a concern from a business perspective as well?
Well, so before I started writing this book, I had this conversation with my wife, and I said, listen, we don't need this, right? Wealthy, have a lot of access. I'm sitting on all of these boards, a lot of ownership in a whole bunch of raft of different technology companies. And if anything, writing this book puts all of that at risk, because it's going up against the system. And if I turn into a pariah, from going up against the system, people can't have me on their boards. It could hurt a lot of our economic well-being, everything else. And so it was that conversation with my wife, and said, but I still have to do it. So yes, very much. But again, this, all the boards that I sit on, or all of the technology entrepreneurs I'm helping, if you actually go down to the root of what they're doing, most of them aren't starting a company to say, I'm going to make the most money and I win the game. Most of them are starting a company to say, how do I create a whole bunch of value for society? So in that, and using technology differently to create a whole bunch of value, is what they're really doing.
Right.
So I wouldn't be on any board that didn't actually think about, how do I create a whole bunch of value for society?
Right.
So even though that I had that it could look like this, I think I pretty much knew any of the people I work with would back me 100%.
Sure. So let's get into the book a bit. You know, I think we agree we're in the age of inflation, but I think we should start there. And I don't know if you get asked this question too often or not enough, but what is inflation?
The simplest explanation is when your money is worth less over time. So it has different winners, losers. If your money is worth less over time, then debt gets less expensive over time because you pay it back with cheaper money tomorrow. So if you hold a lot of debt, inflation is a really good thing. If you hold assets, inflation takes those assets up with it. But it's also really bad for money or people that are on, say, fixed income, or because it's losing money.
Right. And how would you explain deflation?
It's the opposite side of that coin. So your money is worth more over time. Goods and services go down in price related to that money. And so, Sutter, in that conversation, is there's a whole bunch of people, less people that have read my book, they're starting to understand this. And a lot of people are starting to understand this construct. But money is just a construct of our time. And inflation is just a construct we believe in. And we set up the rules that it's always a good thing without even questioning, is it a good thing?
Right.
There's a whole bunch of people you're taught in school that we have to have inflation. Where central banks come out and say, we have to have 2% inflation. It's so good for society. And that's kind of that scratching it, something that we've always been taught to be true might just not be true, and that breaks your brain and says, okay, why is your money going down in value a good thing? Why is that universally a good thing? Maybe it's not.
Right. So I just reread the book. The first time I read it was probably in March or April, maybe February, but probably March or April. And looking back on it, it feels like 10 years ago. And rereading it now, I say to myself, if I was reading this 10 years ago, I would be so optimistic. I would be running out of the room, screaming, looking for ways to take a lot of the ideas you put forth around technology and getting involved. And now, having gone through the year, I'm a little less optimistic, because 2020 is what it is. And it's still the opposite of, coming into the year and reading this book, I thought this idea is in hand. We're going to handle things differently. And we've got, not doubled down, we've gone 10X, I feel like.
So when it's amazing how many people do exactly what you're saying. Read the book, then read it again, then read it again, then read it again. Because what we're talking about here is it changes what you're thinking from one system to another system. But we measure all of our outcomes from an existing system. So it's really hard for our brains to comprehend what a new system could look like. And so I explore some of that in the book. But to I think what your point is I laid out in the book how technology was exponentially deflationary, or exponential, if it created exponential efficiency, and that efficiency was deflationary, and it was going up against a monetary system that required inflation. So you could expect exponential monetary easing on the other side.
Right.
And all that COVID did is accelerated what I'm talking about. It's just an accelerator. Technology is moving faster. I think a lot of people think technology is an industry instead of it's the base layer of everything that we're doing.
Like a first principle.
Yeah, but more of a, if you think about the rest of the world, we used to kind of industries and this industry and this industry and this industry. And they think, okay, technology is its own industry. Let's measure technology. In fact, the Fed, you can't measure productivity gains out of something that moves to free.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we still measure productivity gains in all of the language that we want to see GDP go up. But how does GDP go up from free photos? Right? How does that happen? And that, so that, that's kind of, so a whole bunch of our constructs in measuring the existing system are wrong, completely wrong, because technology is moving into the base layer of everything we're doing. This video conference we're on, we couldn't have done this 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I see this in my own life with just podcasting. The hardware has come down in price. The software is providing everything for free that they used to pay a technician to help provide for you, or something of that sort. And you point a lot of things out in the book, especially in the beginning, to set the framework and to kind of get our heads around exponentiality. And you talk about with, you know, governments printing trillions of dollars and trying to understand that 1 trillion seconds is equal to 31,709 years, just to kind of give some perspective. And what I also found interesting is you have an anecdote about having dinner with your friend Chen Fang and mentioning his parents and them kind of getting a little nervous about what's happening. And they mentioned this quip around first currency wars, then trade wars, and then real wars. And where do you think we are in that sort of parable or thought, or are we not in that moment? Right, you know,
we're absolutely in that, and so again, if people could see that all of the pricing of everything around them is just an illusion out of money printing, and that's hard to see, right? So I've used this on a number of podcasts, but so one of the things, if my thesis was right, that technology is driving exponentially more efficiency, then something on the other side of that ledger should prove that thesis correct. So in the beginning of the book, I talked about, we have $250 trillion of debt to run an $80 trillion global economy.
Right.
And that's not, and those numbers are so staggering. But you could say, if you believed in fairy tales, you could say maybe we can grow our way out of it. If there's new industries created and we could grow our way out of it, if it was just status quo, but taxes would have to go up to grow our way out of it, right? We'd have to pay back the debt, and the debt is such a staggering amount. But then when you realize $185 trillion of that debt has come over the last 20 years, you see the smoking gun. So thesis, technology is driving this, everything more efficient, deflation, and massive amounts of easing, exponentially more each year, are needed to try to stop that, to pretend we still live in an inflationary world. So okay, now what's the consequence of, that's looking backwards, that's to 2019. So looking forwards, if technology is still moving exponentially, you have to expect that $185 trillion looks like child's play looking backwards compared to what's needed in the looking forwards to stop that. And that's what we're seeing. Now, in that game, because again, we don't measure these things at the system level, we measure them by independent variables. We look at our housing and we say, housing always goes up.
Right.
But and fail to ask, would housing have gone up without $185 trillion of liquidity, extra liquidity, over the last 20 years? And the simple answer is no, housing would be like, it'd be, in other words, it's mispriced, massively mispriced, as everything else is, because of that liquidity, that easing, pulling forward demand. So the next question is, how long can that continue? But not just continue $105 trillion over the years, exponentially more, to be able to fight the other force of technological deflation. And so potentially it can continue if governments can continue printing resetting their currencies, essentially devaluing the currencies forever, then it can continue, because really what they're doing is they're pouring money into a hole. But when you change the rules of what money is, by making up new money, somebody loses on the other side of that bet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of losers on that other side of that bet, including anybody on fixed wages, anybody. And so you see kind of revolution emerging as really the number revolution in wars emerging as the number one threat to society, because you're manipulating this. So everything's mispriced, everything. It's not natural, but we all live in that mispriced world. And we know it's going to be more mispriced going forward. And so a whole bunch of the wealthy try to put their money in assets that are going to take advantage of that mispricing.
Right.
Which is, they're making good decisions in a world gone crazy.
Right, right. When did your thesis start to really form for you? For myself, I remember in college getting my finance degree, and long-term capital management was when the framework for me kind of broke. I didn't form a thesis out of it and write a book, but and then, you know, in 2006, 2007, I had returned home to suburbia Long Island from San Francisco. And I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood, lots of teachers, plumbers, electricians, and people in those fields can do very well. But I would walk around and everybody had, you know, new siding and brand new $30,000 cars. And you can tell this was all financed through debt. And that was in 2006, 2007. And then, you know, 2008, we have the great financial crisis. And recently I think you spoke in front of the House of Commons, and that's kind of the reason I'm bringing up maybe those events and government. And also when I was in grad school, we studied a lot of accounting fraud, and most of the accounting fraud examples that we studied, the fines never really amounted to anything near the gains from the fraud that usually was settled in a no fault agreement. So, you know, one side could argue they were just being aggressive. And so with that underpinning of how much fraud do you think is in, you know, Fortune 500 companies or the S&P 500? And when did you start to formulate this thesis around debt and the black hole?
So just realizing that this is a system change. Now, remember, in any system change, they cannot work together. An inflationary monetary policy is incongruent with where technology is going. Technology tries to make everything cheaper, more abundant, and an inflationary monetary policy does the opposite. These are forces that are competing against each other that cannot coexist. The only way they can coexist is with concentration of power by the state, essentially destroying all free market. That's the only way they can coexist. Right. So likely they could coexist if people believed in a fairy tale of money and government power forever, and saying, okay, you make all the decisions for me, then they can coexist. That would look pretty dystopian.
Mm-hmm.
That would look like what China is trying to do with their currency control. So, but otherwise, these things cannot coexist. So that was the realization. The technology is moving. So the technology, when I saw what was happening in every single business that I was involved in, that my first business cost me over $5 million to create the technology platform that Shopify today does for $50 a month. And Shopify's platform today is like 100 times better than what I created with over 2 years with $5 million. It's the point of technology. It reduces prices and increase abundance. And so Kodak going broke. And it's not like we use less photos today.
Right.
The number of photos is so staggering that we use today. And storage has collapsed in price. Everything has collapsed in price along that same axis. We have all of that abundance. We have it on our phones. We have it in everything we do. So if it's moving at that pace, why is everything going up in price? It forces you to ask kind of just a first principle question and saying it shouldn't be. And then you find, then, and with that, you find the smoking gun, right? And then you realize as you look at, oh my God, how much credit is being created out of thin air, what that means, and all of the repercussions to society, you just, oh my, there's a reset coming. And that reset can come in a number of different forms, but there is a reset coming.
What do you think is the key to maybe bringing on that reset sooner than later, hopefully in a more positive way? But is it changing hearts and minds of the masses? Is it getting to certain key individuals with a book like yours? Is it through government? You know, I don't say that maybe with positive, negative connotations.
I recently had a call from editor-in-chief of one of the major papers. And I'm not going to say which one at this point, because there's going to be pieces coming out in time. Sure. But he said to me, he said, I read your book last year, and it was impossible to disagree with any of it. And I sent it to some top people in government, finance, and everything else, Blackstone, the works. And got back, we have to keep printing. Not, this is wrong. We have to keep printing. And what he said to me over a couple hour conversation is, he said, and media is not doing our job. We're in media not doing our job, because everybody's going back to the exact same people saying, how do we solve this? And the exact same people are creating the mess. Now they're stuck. Now he didn't say this. This is what I say. It's not bad. It's not bad actors. Not invariably all bad people. It's there. You could change an actor in a system, and it won't change the system. Right. They are stuck in a system that cannot be solved from the existing system. It's impossible. It's mathematically impossible to solve what we're talking. It's like, and I use this example in the book, it's like Blockbuster solving Netflix from their stores. It's impossible. They're two totally different systems, and they can't be solved. So that's why Bitcoin is advancing so fast. And actually the best chance for a peaceful transition is Bitcoin. That's a bold statement, but I believe it to be true, because it's a forcing function that is a different system. System change very rarely comes from within. And what we're seeing is, name somebody right now, try to find somebody who doesn't want more easing.
Right.
So whether it's more printing for the left or the right, I'm gonna make up money for these people, I'm gonna make up money for these people. There is no free market anymore. It's gone. And everybody requires, and if there isn't any easing, the system would collapse. Asset prices would collapse by 90%. Homelessness everywhere, banking failure around the globe, and it would be a hard reset. And then it would grow, then be reformed in some new system on the other side. That's what would happen today. So it's no wonder in that policy environment, you have governments, every one of them, trying to outprint each other, because they know that that's true. And right. Every time they make the system more fragile. But the question is, what would you have them do? There's a whole bunch of population that, because they created this problem and didn't know they were creating it, trying to outrun it, grow the way they have always grown, tiny little bit of inflation will manipulate markets more. And then it got more and more and more as technology was going the other way. Now we're way too late. What would you have them do?
Is part of the race to win printing the most money and then be forgiven on repayment?
So again, what ends up happening in that is, if you can create money out of nothing. So what do you think's happening in the geopolitical game today? What's happening between US and China? So China realizes, wait, we can do this too.
Right.
We can create a digital yuan. If I get people to take this, I can create Belt and Road in Africa. If I get people to take my thing that I can just make up out of thin air, and then they can pay me back, I control them through a debt instrument,
yep,
rather than force. I control them through an economic means rather than force, and they have to play by my rules. But when there's multiple countries all doing the exact same thing, you can kind of see where that goes.
Right. Looking at China, do you think a state like China, the party, does it fail because it's human led, and it's centralized, and eventually it crumbles on itself because they end up making bad decisions, or how much do you think there's a potential for them to succeed and continue to export, central banking colonialism, and social media surveillance?
If Bitcoin doesn't win. If there's, then China might win. Because if central banks try to do that, then each central bank is going to control their citizens through that, and then those central banks are going to try to make their digital currencies stronger against other currencies and trading blocks from their digital currencies, all fighting and playing that same game. So you can create Bitcoin solves that. In fact, I think if Bitcoin happened faster, I think if the US goes and embraces it or something, which is much higher likelihood, because if you look at the US Constitution and everything else, it was all around rights and freedoms of the individual, which created innovation, strong economy, everything else. And now it's moving far away from that. But I suspect that if any country could kind of embrace what Bitcoin stands for, it's actually going to be the US. And you can see in some of the regulation, it's actually moving that way. But if that happens, it's kind of checkmate for China's digital yuan. It's a forcing function for that as well. It's actually probably the best thing geopolitically that could happen. I'm careful on some of these things, because these are all probability events, and you're dealing with something that is such a magnitude on all of our lives that it's bound to not be a straight line, right? There's going to be some thrashing back and forth, different policies and everything else. When you hear things like the Great Reset, spoken from multiple different politicians all at the same time, realize that there's a whole bunch of stuff happening behind that conversation to be able to say, here's how we're going to talk about it. So that Great Reset is probably different governments coming together and creating a different unit of currency, unit of account, to try to bring this back together with a whole bunch of, but what's great about a reset, right? And what you're doing and what people are doing is emboldening more government control, because that's what's happening. Or when you hear build back better, right? When you hear all these things. Now, if it was one institution, I am not for conspiracy theories. This is actors in a system doing the best to protect this system.
Yeah.
But when you hear something multiple from different places, there's coordination happening behind the scenes on this. When you think about, and I've said this numerous times as well, but, and I say it because no one else is saying it. Wherever you are on the environmental discussion, climate change discussion, realize that all governments today talking about climate change because people believe it's such a big deal, and it is, it's a big deal. And they say, we're going to invest in solving climate change, and we're going to print more money to be able to solve climate change. Think of that oxymoron.
Right.
Because yeah. you can't. The existing system can't solve climate change.
I love how you point this out as the biggest problem of climate.
Yeah, it's an order of magnitude bigger problem on climate than anything else.
It's just an amazing connection.
But nobody talks about it.
Right, no, nobody.
And
everyone wants to use the money to solve the problem. I'm getting that from your words. I'm taking that from you, but yeah.
Yeah, so they're trying to... Because within the system, if you lower price and create green energy, then the system needs to manipulate currency more to disrupt your gain. So the existing system cannot solve climate change. It is climate change. And what ends up happening is most of the participants in the system believe people saying, here's why we need to create more money to be able to help you.
Right. Before we turn to more technology, because I really wanted to dive into a lot of what you bring up in the book there. You know, in terms of people in government, and it's not so much a conspiracy theory, it's just people acting with rational incentives and trying to figure out best solutions within the framework that they've been presented. And it is a system that maybe overarches a lot of people's individual abilities to turn the boat around. But how much of it do you think is rational incentives in the system, maybe mal, meaning I might be encouraged to make the pie smaller so that my slice of the pie gets bigger versus let's grow the pie for everyone and the benefit of humanity and more that optimistic view of what to do with the choices at hand?
You know, from the book, I talked about game theory and incentives and what we think. In a book like that, I had to cover a lot of ground and simplify these things to make it consumable mm-hmm. so people could put the picture together. But some of these things, if you take kind of game theory, what you're saying is, I care about my family first, me first. We don't think about everyone else in every interaction. Most times we think about what we are individually. We look at our own photos. We look at our own media. We constantly reinforce me, 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 me. Then it's our family. Then it's our friends and community. Then it's nation states. Then all of these things are just how people think. Not good, not bad, not anything else. So it's really, really hard to go the other way and say, I'm going to think about everybody and not me. So when you think about game theory and everything else and these incentives, just go back to that and say, if you have a choice, you individually have a choice. Use Bitcoin as an example. That's what's driving it too, right? I can go in right now and I can protect me and my family and gain a whole bunch of wealth. Be a rational decision. Then you think about the next level. Then you think about the next level. Then you think about the next level. And all of these things are just constant. If I can buy a house now, get in now before everybody else is in and it's going to go up, you don't need more and more of these things. You need some of them to live.
Right.
But they're all rational decisions individually. To be able to take more advantage, and when the system is gamed, when the entire system is gamed, you can expect a lot of those a lot more of that to happen.
Yeah, I agree. My son always turns to me, and he's kind of like, "When are we getting some new technology?" And I'm always like, there's new technology every day. You're using it. It's coming out all the time. And he's like, no. When are things going to get like bigger, better, different? Something like a new, you know, I mean, for him, that means like a new, Nintendo Switch or, you know, yeah. some sort of
yeah.
new evolution to the things that he's looking at. But what I'm getting at like here is you've touched on a lot of, with your work, you've gotten a lot of opportunities to get like a look at technology. And not that technology is one thing, which is what, and so I want to kind of break it up into different verticals of different aspects of technology that's been kind of coming out or been talked about recently for years, you know, self-driving cars, artificial intelligence, where are we? Let's start with one, like self-driving cars. Like, how fast is this coming about? How much can this enhance our economy and our lives? Or is this more of still something maybe that's more of a 20, 30 year thing?
So instead of focusing on anyone, because in the immediate time frame on this, you'll be wrong by a year or two on any immediate one. And actually, by the way, that's a concept that a number of people mistook the book for, because recency bias, which we all have, will look at existing events right now and discounts what's happening underneath. And so some people looked at the artificial intelligence chapter and everything else. By the way, there is nothing in the artificial intelligence chapter that is not true from a first principles, and I'm very close to it. I'm very close to it. So what's happening in that realm, in some of the different research and different pieces that take deep learning to probabilistic program to other things, to eventually the singularity where computers are smarter than all humans, is a thing, and it's a big thing. Now, what people are looking for and what you just asked is, when's the light switch? Right. And that's the thing that is so crazy about not the question, but we think about it in, because we're in the system, we think about it, okay, when will everything change and all jobs go away? And that's not the point. The point is it's actually more and more deflationary. It's more and more efficient all the way along until one day it's completely free. Or it's one day it's completely, it just keeps on getting more efficient. And so there doesn't need to be a light switch. And what the other thing that you asked is, when is our economy better because of that? It's not. It's continually worse because it's competing against that system. And so people are looking for more and more jobs out of this. And they don't realize that more inflation to get more and more jobs, the opposite side of the coin of inflation is wage deflation, right? So you're holding on to jobs by making the jobs less of a component of the overall picture by making labor cheaper. And you're tricking society into doing that. So they're working over and over and over in a job that's not required anymore, that otherwise would have gone away because technology would have removed it. But if the job went away and you forced prices this high, then everybody fails. And they're scared to death that they can't eat, they can't house themselves, everything else, because they're measuring a system that is so overpriced that requires prices to continually go up, and their wages are going down in that. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Whereas if you actually let nature take its course, I'm not talking about the transition is difficult. If you let nature take its course, prices would fall so fast on everything, and they would keep falling too free in a bunch of stuff. So they would just keep on going down, and you would live in a different, you would get the abundance without the game that's being played.
Yeah. Let's take the economy out of it. And let's say we've gone through the reset, or we don't go through the reset, regardless of the reset. I listened to a conversation with Peter Thiel and Eric Weinstein, where they talked about how it sometimes feels like things haven't changed much since the 1970s. And I think you answered my question already, though, where in the sense that, you know, I already look at my iPhone as an extension of my brain. And so I get what you're saying in the sense that there's not going to be a switch where we go from that moment to it's embedded in my body somewhere and just giving me more information. It's just going to be gradually. But I was really, you know, like you were talking about, like, you know, the Yeezy beat was being printed out of liquid with 3D printing and additive manufacturing. And I'm just kind of curious, like, when, like, again, economy aside, like, when might those things be more prevalent? And I guess I'm not asking for when, but like, do you think those things are coming at us?
Way faster than people imagine. So what is, I forget, I'm trying to think of the guy's name. But the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed.
Right.
William Gibson. But when you see what I'm fortunate enough to be able to see in a whole bunch of this, it's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. Why is it not evenly distributed? Because some of it's coming out of the labs. Some of it's attacking. If you use 3D additive manufacturing, where would that start? It would probably start in the most expensive industries as it gained traction before it got to us. So just have your listeners go and look at how many airplane parts are created out of additive manufacturing, and you'll realize how fast this is moving. You have a look, and as that reduces its price and increases its efficiency, additive manufacturing gets better and better, and it moves into society. So it makes sense that these industries, as they move, that technology moves in, it starts at industries that are high cost, reducing prices there first, creating that abundance, and then scales out across the board. And that's exactly what is happening. And we miss, as a general population, because it's not in our everyday lives yet, we miss how fast it's happening.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so let's turn back to climate. And again, I kind of want to return to some of this, just the future of energy and water desalination, and like just the notion of, I mean, what if the U.S. Army couldn't afford like the price of oil?
Well, so oil is still a huge part. Again, there's another example, like AI, that people are looking at a binary number. Okay, here's free energy, or when this happens, and trying to. Oil is still a huge component of the whole energy infrastructure. And solar is a tiny component, growing really fast and decreasing price every year as it grows. But today, it's already one of the lowest cost energy forms, and it's getting cheaper every year. So if you play the trend on what that means, oil prices are going to fall, which is more deflationary. And as that happens, prices are going, there's more new energy coming on at lower costs, and more and more and more at lower costs. You can see that that one of the number one drivers of everything else, because energy is a construct in everything we do, everything that's used is built using energy. The entire war machine is really to protect energy, because if you had a lower cost energy, your economy was better. And that structural change is happening in our lifetimes. It's happening right now. And we can see it around us. And again, people are looking to the light switch moment. And light switch moment doesn't matter at all. It's just, if you look at the trend on what's happening, it's already right in front of us. It means prices should be coming down everywhere. Why are they not? It's because we're printing money to make them go up.
Mm. Well, you know, with the central bank digital currencies and the notion of money getting digitized, fiat money, which it virtually is digitized already, or it's digital. But in terms of what they can do with the CBTC, CBDC, I'm almost framing that up as more of a war and battle between commercial banks and central banks. And that it's not so much about Bitcoin.
Have you read my new piece?
No, I have not. No.
Oh, it's either... I just put it out in my newsletter, but it's going to be released any minute. But it explores this at a way deeper level. And what has to happen what has to happen against the existing system, and how that benefits Bitcoin, and what a new system will look like over time. But that next step of, it simply asks this, why for the longest time, JP Morgan and all the banks, everyone was totally against Bitcoin, and now why are they for it?
Well, I mean, I'm gonna let that one to you. I'm gonna give that one to you.
Because they were the number one beneficiary of printing, because they were at the top of the stack, and they could take all their bad loans, bad assets, put them on the feds, and get new money to be able to create and lend to society just on an accounting trick. And so that whole stack was at the top of the pyramid, and they were the biggest beneficiaries of all of the banks were the biggest beneficiaries of central bank policies over the last 30 years.
Right.
They couldn't lose because they couldn't fail.
Yeah.
So it's a really good place to have a one-way bet to win. And as central bank as those banks start to realize that the next step, governments have to consolidate control and get into the distribution business, the last part of the free market or quasi-free market dies. And all of those banks realize, oh my God, I'm not needed anymore as a transfer mechanism to get this money to society. The next step is I'm gone. The transfer mechanism is the government.
Right. Is UBI laced into that as a mechanism
absolutely.
To distribute and identify?
Yeah, it's and on both sides. It means if you had a central bank digital currency and they needed to take interest rates to minus 10 and pick your pocket tomorrow, they could do that. They could, so that your entire well-being is on somebody else's control.
How would you stop Bitcoin if you were a government?
I think it's too late. I honestly think they can't. They could, if enough got together. So if you look at the risks, a lot of people that are listening to this won't have looked at all of the this as deep as maybe I have or others have, and they'll come out with the same tried and true. Here's what. And they'll miss how fast this is moving. But today, how could you slow it? When I talk about the Great Reset and everything else, if you could have enough governments come together and create a new unit of value and agree on the rules that looked something like Bitcoin, that still gave them control, and so that Great Reset kind of idea, Build Back Better idea, if enough of governments came together to do that, you could slow Bitcoin, but because people would believe, they might believe, okay, and then slow the on-ramps to Bitcoin, off-ramps of Bitcoin. I suspect in this environment, for those governments to come together to reset all of their imbalances and fiscal and everything else in this global trade thing, in this environment, that's an impossible task. It's an impossible task at the U.S. level, Republicans and Democrats, let alone international governments and everything else.
Right.
And why? For the same thing we talked about in game theory before. Because everybody's after their own best interests. And so those types of events are typically only reset through war. Not through people coming together to try to, there's a reset through war. And so by the time that governments try to figure what that looks like, Bitcoin is going to have broad adoption, and it's going to be a forcing function.
Right.
But if you asked what could happen, that is probably something that could slow it, not stop it.
Right. You mentioned in the book that Bitcoin is less concentrated today than the current economic system. And I wonder, you know, outlandish thought, if they could use money printing to race to concentrate Bitcoin to the money printers, regardless of price. So now, you know, price is just racing, and it's meaningless to people who can't get any sort of enough fiat into the system. But the people who have the most fiat then can pay the bigger prices.
So as they do that, their fiat will get destroyed in value.
Mm-hmm, right.
So again, if you tried to use Venezuelan fiat today to buy Bitcoin, you're not going to buy very much.
Right. But I'm just asking, on the other side of it, could we just be left with a similar situation where because maybe it's concentrated, and through a fair mechanism of using the money first to get to it, we could maybe not get some of the benefits that we're hoping for.
So again, in some of this, I just think that at the top level, at the very top level, technology today, technology, innovation, a free market requires a currency that allows for deflation. It requires it because every other path concentrates wealth and power. That fair?
Yeah. Yeah.
Every other path concentrates wealth and power, manipulation. So today where we are in technology, it's a requirement of any monetary policy that it allows for deflation. Otherwise you concentrate wealth and power. If now go to the next level, what is the most likely candidate to drive that change? The most likely candidate already, how fast Bitcoin is growing, is the candidate that is a forcing function from outside the system to inside, is a forcing function to that change. Can there be a whole bunch of stuff? Will there be a whole bunch of stuff in the existing system that tries to protect it? Like Blockbuster adding candy aisles to their stores? Yes. Can it solve the problem? No. So I know what bet I'm going to make. I know what I know when I see what's happening, and where I'm going to place bets as a result of this, and not just from a monetary gain standpoint. In fact, probably the least you can tell by the way I wrote the book. I care about the bigger tail risk of wars and what this looks like, or a bigger tail risk than that, concentration of power by the state. Absolutely unequivocally that I have no rights. That's what I care about.
Yeah. And I got that. Your book is to me tremendously optimistic. I got that you're an optimistic person, but it laid out a lot of pessimistic facts and notions for me. And that's my internal struggle. And I continuously vacillate between just incredible hope for humanity, you know, and looking at some of these facts and a little depressed over just how things continue to plod along.
And it's not to say I'm not as well. You could tell by the House of Commons speech that I gave. And what I realize is there's nothing they can do. There's nothing that the existing system can do. And the more that they try to pile money into this, the worse they make it for society. They're blowing up a balloon that is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger the balloon, the bigger the pop on the other side. That's what I realized. And that's unfortunate. And I wish I could put my head in the sand and say, it's not true, but it is true. And nothing that all of the people inside the system that are blaming each other and pointing fingers about that change that. I expect people to blame each other. I expect that they're screaming into the vortex, one side versus the other, not realizing the thing that's in the middle of the whole thing.
Right.
That's creating all of the pain. And there's nothing we can do about it. I wish that wasn't true. What gives me an ability to write a book like that, and I've done that all my life. That's what an entrepreneur does. They have a viewpoint for a better future. They work like hell, and if they're right and they could provide better value for society, and they get through the pain of what the old monopoly looks like and the market looks like, if they can get through all of that and they do this, then they win. And the only way they win is by providing value to society. So if you're that person, you almost have to hold two thoughts concurrently at the same time. What the existing system looks like and why it looks like this, and then what it will do to try to protect itself as you move to a new system, and as you try to accrue benefits to whoever can accrue benefits to the new system. And but those two different things, because they're so different, are really hard for people to control in their minds. They go into the one system and essentially they're so scared of the transition or anything else, that they can't actually look at logic. So they go back to, well, I need more money. The government should print more money and give it to me.
Right. You ask a few questions towards the end of the book that you know, I ask myself every day. You framed them up really well, though. And some of the reasons I've kind of just kind of maybe even challenged you on some of these notions, because you say, how many of our own beliefs stand up to the facts? To future generations, how many of our current actions fueled by those beliefs will look outright foolish? How do we overcome our errors, biases, and narratives that make up our operating system? And I ask, you know, these questions because I have so much conviction. You know, I believe you do too. And I still want to challenge our convictions. You know, and one of the, that made me think a lot about how, you know, with just technology, how much information we deal with every day, how the world's information is doubling at an incredible rate. And how do you decide or choose what information to consume and maybe even in what form? Because, you know, time management is an issue. Time is scarce. You're not going to know everything in the world. Therefore, like maybe even we're wrong about some of the things we're convicted on. And I'm not getting that Bitcoin here, maybe other things in our lives. But, you know, how do you deal with all that?
I constantly ask myself, so I wrote the book in a way to try to teach other people to do some of the same things I do to do that. And by doing that, if you put yourself first with humility and say, I make these mistakes too, we all do. So you can notice even on Twitter, a lot of times I don't say you, I say we, and me, I also make them. And then what do I do to try to avoid those mistakes? So you just actually hit on a really interesting thread that I think about. Every abundance creates a scarcity. So today we have an abundance of information and misinformation. And so you could spend, and so that's one. Two, on that, we are likely to click on things that we like or agree with and hang out with people that we like and agree with, because they because it's easier. It reinforces our belief system. So I'm bombarded with information, and we don't like to look at information that doesn't match our narrative. Me too. We all do. It's a natural fact. And so how do I, if that's the truth, and I'm just as likely as everybody else to do that, make sure that I spend my time, my most valuable asset, in things that don't get sucked into that vortex. So that I spend my time. And it's hard. So you have to force yourself to look at other points of view with a really open mind. To be able to debate somebody else's point of view, like you know it better than them. And then come back to yours and look at something from all sides to realize that. And you can't do that on every single item. You just don't have the time to do it on every single item. So where are the things that are deeper? First principles that are, and money's pretty big. And money and power are pretty big. So right. What are the ones that are core to a whole bunch of other decisions I might get wrong too? Go deeper on those ones and then just keep asking why. Is it a belief or is it a fact? And that's really important today, because there's a whole bunch of people, you see it on Twitter all the time, that are shouting because of a belief. And a belief that's completely wrong, that doesn't have any facts. So is it a belief or a fact? And just keep on asking, why do I believe that? Is that true? Is it for sure true, or is it a belief? But I understand, because it's hard for anybody to do that. And the more information silos as a result of those two things make it even harder.
Right. This has been so incredible, Jeff. I appreciated this so much. You know, I definitely want to leave it to you for any parting words.
No, probably the only thing is the same thing I've said on a number of these podcasts. In an environment like this, where what we've talked about in a lot of this podcast is the environment we all live in, that's the system we live in, you should expect that a whole bunch of people have been manipulated to think one thing. And you should forgive them on their yelling and everything else, because people are in pain. People don't know how to solve it. And very few people have the wherewithal to go to down to the root cause of it all. If you have, and if you understand Bitcoin, if you understand what that looks like, help people get there. Bridge that divide. and you'll do a way better job in helping create a future that matters for everybody.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Then they touched on that, because that is something I really appreciated about your book, and that point of notion of empathy. I think you've tweeted about it as well. Maybe that's where I saw it. And just to empathize with and have patience with people. And those are the things I really took from your book is optimism and patience, and that it's going to be a great wild ride in a lot of ways, just because you, again, with the technology, you touched on a lot of things that got me excited again that I haven't been excited about for a long time. I really encourage everyone to read it either a first time or a second time or a third time, The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. Where can everyone find you? Just so that we get that correct.
Probably best just at Jeff Booth on Twitter.
Yep. And at Price of Tomorrow on Twitter as well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I have a team on that.
Yeah. This has been awesome, Jeff. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sutter. Yeah.
Jeff Booth on why deflation is the key to an abundant future and how Bitcoin is the forcing function on the other side of the equation, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, vote with your thumbs and press 5 stars in that app and subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. That's the best way to get the word out so we can keep grinding out thought-provoking chats about Bitcoin. This is Cedric. Peace.